Hey, everybody. I'm Kat. I'm an alcoholic. Let's have an AA meeting. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way that they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them, too. I must have this thing. And Rusty is going to come up and introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Kim. I'm Rusty Jones. I'm a very grateful alcoholic.
Hey, Rusty.
And I heard Pat speak at Clarkston several months ago. And it was exciting to hear somebody, particularly a female who has been around a long time, a very solid, courageous young lady who's, well, first thing to have a hell of a story, you got to live a hell of a life. And Pat has done that. Pat, come tell us your story.
My name is Pat, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
I have notes because the older I get, the harder it is to remember stuff. So, first of all, thank you, Tim, for asking me to speak, and thank you, Rusty, for asking Tim to ask me to speak. And I'm going to start my talk the way I learned back in Toledo, Ohio, and I'm going to end it the same way. The person I heard my first couple of weeks had been sober since God was a boy, and his sponsor had been sober even further back than that. So we were in Ohio, and I figure it may actually have some connection with the founders. And he said it like this: don't drink, go to meetings, read the book, and pray. Right? Don't drink, go to meetings, read the book, and pray. So I was born in 1959 in Toledo, Ohio. My father was a graduate of West Point, and he met my mother, who was much younger than he, and came from a poverty-stricken family. And they got married and had us, and they moved up north. He was a flight instructor for the Army Air Force, and they moved up to Toledo. And his father owned a quarry. Now, alcoholism goes back at least four generations in my family, and that's just because I don't know what the fifth was like. My first 8 years of life were blissful. I had lots of friends. I did well in school. I was very happy. Seemed like the sun was always shining. And my father started drinking heavily when I was about 8 years old, 9 years old. And he also began a 20-plus year affair with a woman named Jackie. And my parents stayed together, but she was sort of always in the background. And my mother became increasingly unhappy. And so around fourth grade, I started missing a lot of school. I was very sick much of the time. I was in and out of hospitals, getting unnecessary testing, and I won't say what I think, but you can follow the dots. So right around seventh or eighth grade, I think I was about 13 years old, I met a group of kids. I mean, I was so lonely. I was that kid that you invited to the party, and they said, you know, why'd you invite her? You know, I just get so excited to be around other children for a change. I just spaz out. And so I met a group of kids who would accept me, and those were the Wild Kids. And I think my parents were so happy that I just had friends that our house became this open door, and we had no rules. So I went from a tiny little cocoon of never being around people to just No rules. I was staying out at 14 years old. I was staying out till 4:30 at night. As long as my friend Ned, who really was just a friend, I had a lot of big guy friends, but they all sort of thought of me as a sister. And as long as I was with him, I could do anything I wanted. I drank at home. I smoked at home. We smoked dope up in the garage, and there's no way they couldn't have known this. When I was 14 or 15 years old, I stopped my best friend from being gang raped. It was like, and we were home without parents, and it wasn't that I had a party because my parents were out. It was, I had the party and my parents left because it was too loud. So they left this group of drunk 14-year-olds alone, and things happened. Bill Wilson tells us to talk about our first drunk and our last drunk. My first drunk was when I was about 13 years old. Everybody I knew was starting to drink, and I thought I'd better give it a try. And so I did an experiment at home because I wanted to make sure I didn't make a total fool out of myself while drinking. And I really needn't have bothered because, yes, I did. But I took a can of Hawaiian Punch, and I took a fifth of vodka, broke the seal. Nobody was going to give me a hard time about that. And I proceeded to take the first drink. And the first thing I remember is this warmth coming up my legs. I remember a feeling of relaxation coming over me. And I thought, wow, this is wonderful. This must be how other people feel. My second thought was, I don't want this feeling to ever stop. So I continued to drink till I drank a half a fifth of vodka. I maybe weighed 88, 89 pounds at the time. I had my first blackout during that drinking experience. And for me, blackouts, I know some people have different types of blackouts. Oh, there are other people over here on this side of the room. Okay. Other people have different types of blackouts, but mine was like the light is on, the light goes off, the light goes on, and I'm somewhere else doing something else. You know, as I got older, it was getting on airplanes and going across the country and getting sort of semi-sober, you know, on the way to see my friends. But at any rate, my mother came in, and I was talking on the phone to some man I'd called. Not a clue as to where I'd found him, whether it was just random, had I made other calls. Not a clue. But he was trying to find out where I lived and could he come and get me. And the minute he heard my mother's voice, he hung up. And no caller ID back then or anything like that. So my mother said to me, "Oh, Pat, don't drink alone. That'll make you an alcoholic." Okay. Don't drink alone. So I started drinking very socially. And by the time I was 17, every friend of mine knew I had a problem with alcohol. They were actually saying things to me like, you know, this really isn't your drug. Maybe you should try cocaine. Things like that. And I was just not fun to be around when I drank. One of my favorite things to do would be to go into a bar with all these big guys, and I don't know why I thought this was hilarious, but I would find some big guy in the bar, and I would talk to him, and if he said something I didn't like, I would throw my drink in his face, and he would go jumping towards me, and all my big guy friends would come and beat him up. I just thought this was great fun. When I was 16 or 17, I met a guy named Danny, and he was a coke runner. I met him in a bar in Fort Lauderdale. I had this little blue card that I used. It was my sister's card from when she'd stayed at the Medical College of Ohio, which is where we lived. And it had her name, and it had her birthday. And I would go sit up at a bar and order a drink. They'd ask for my ID, and I'd show them this little blue card. And they would say, oh, honey, you know, we need a driver's license or a picture ID. And I'd look at them, straight-faced, and say, I have epilepsy, and I'm not allowed to have a driver's license. So the Medical College of Ohio gave me this so I would have an ID. And 9 times out of 10, it would work. And the 10% of the time, they never confiscated it because they weren't really sure. And, you know, who wants to take an ID away from a poor epileptic kid? By the by, I don't have epilepsy. Danny finally left, and I managed to scrape it together enough to graduate from high school. And I managed to get into a pretty good school, better than I deserved. It was a very small school up in Michigan, and I did fine academically, but socially, I mean, I was just constantly embarrassing my friends and humiliating myself and falling out of my chair at 8 a.m. in the morning in the middle of chemistry class and climbing back up onto my chair. So I just left. And I went to the local university, which was not, you know, a highly ranked university, but it was probably better for my major. And while I was there, you know, every time I went to one of these places, I thought, this is going to be different. Like, when I went to the college, you know, I had this hair that went all the way down my back, and I dressed in hippie clothes because I was a hippie wannabe. And I got my hair cut short, and I got the little Farrah Fawcett do. Does anybody remember that? Yeah, and I bought a bunch of little sundresses, and I joined a sorority, and I thought everything was going to be okay. And I took me with me, and I took my drinking with me. So went to the local university, and after I'd been there about a year and a half, my friend Sandy sat down with me at her kitchen table, and we'll mention Sandy a little later. And she said, do you know what you did last night? Nope. Do you remember what you said last night? Nope. She said, I really love you, Pat. She had a quiver in her voice. I mean, people had been telling me for years to stop drinking. But there was something about the way she said it, because I could tell she wanted to be anywhere but where she was right at that moment. And she said, you're going downhill fast, and I'm not going to let you take me with you. Wow. So I stopped drinking that day. It never occurred to me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. To me, Alcoholics Anonymous was just no women, in my mind, and guys with, they have a rope to close their coats, and that's about it, you know. So I call that a partial sobriety because I didn't work any steps or do anything like that. And I used cocaine during that, an outside issue during that point in time. And I thought I was having a heart attack one night. And so I took a shot of whiskey to lower my heart rate because I really didn't feel like going to the hospital and explaining why I was maybe having a heart attack. But other than that, for about 18 months to 2 years, I didn't drink. And then I let somebody needle me. I let somebody push me into it. I let them bully me into it. And I was ready. You know, I was sitting next to a girl. I'd gone to high school with her. Everybody knew she was an alcoholic. Everybody knew her mother was a notorious alcoholic. And she starts saying things like, what, you can't just have one? What are you, weak? You know, and I thought, well, you know, I used to be really neurotic. And I'm not neurotic anymore. So maybe I drank the way I drank because I was neurotic. And now that I'm no longer neurotic, blah, 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 you all know, right? Okay, so as I'm taking my first sip, I think to myself, Well, you know, if it turns out that I am an alcoholic, I'm gonna have this gradual decline, and I'll be able to have a little bit of fun, and I'll know what the red flags are, and I'll just, you know, immediately be able to stop drinking. No. It was like falling off of a cliff. And within 6 months, I was in really, really big trouble. I had managed, while I had that partial sobriety, to get into a graduate program in counseling. And it was not working out for me. So I'm going to fast forward to February 17th, 1983, and I'm sitting on my kitchen floor, and I'm crying, and I decided I needed to die. And so I'd gone and I'd taken all the pills from around the house, and I couldn't find any of the good ones. They were all gone. So I started thinking, well, you know, all I'm going to get is, you know, some sort of brain disorder. Important to hear this, okay? My second worst fear is being brain damaged and having someone have to take care of me. Okay? My first biggest fear is public humiliation. And I still wrestle with that today. So my higher power knows this about me. And my higher power has a really good sense of humor. So I went to the medicine cabinet. I thought, well, I'll get in the bathtub. I'll slice. I know where to slice on my leg. And whoever finds me won't have much cleanup to do. And all I could find was a flicker. Is there anybody here old enough to remember flickers? There are these big, giant safety razors in a plastic encasing. And they also had wires that went over the razor blade. So I'm sitting on the floor, and I'm trying to pry it open, and I manage to pry a couple of the little wires off, and I threw it down on the floor, and I looked up and I said, if I'm not going to die, what the hell am I supposed to do? That's only one of two swears you're going to hear in this, but that's what I said. So this little voice in the back of my head says, call suicide hotline. Okay. Sounds good. I'm suicidal. Sounds like a good idea. Okay, now give this some thought that you wouldn't give thought to when you're completely drunk. Guess who works at places like suicide hotline? Counselors in training. Like people of my graduate program. So I called and I talked to a very nice woman, and toward the end of our call, she said, you know, you should really talk to Dr. So-and-so. He's a great guy. And I, you know, all of a sudden the wheels start turning, and I said, how do you know him? And then it was her turn to pause, and she said, I'm one of your classmates. She introduced herself, and I just, here's the second swear, I looked into the phone and I said, oh, shit. And I hung up. Oh, my God. So now by Monday, my whole department, graduate programs are really small. My whole department's going to know, and my department head is going to know. And they're going to start looking at me, and they're going to start wondering why they let me into this graduate program. So I called a friend of the family who was a psychologist. I'd just grown up with him, and I asked him what to do, and typical psychologist, he told me to do what I thought was best, and I thanked him, and, oh, thank you. And so I called my friend Mary, and I asked her to take me to a treatment center. Now, Mary was living with her parents at the time, going to the same graduate school, and her father was my pediatrician. So I thought, well, he knows how to keep confidentiality. What I really wasn't thinking about was that Mary's mother was the worst gossip in our little town. So I hang up and I realize what I've done. She comes over. She doesn't take me to treatment. She takes me to a donut shop where she proceeds to order donut after donut after donut. She gets to the fifth one. Now, she's allowed me, anybody I mention in the program has allowed me, I've already cleared it with them, but she was also a candidate, and she's now in the program where she lives. But she was waiting for me to get sober enough to realize that I wasn't really an alcoholic. Now, think about that. She thought I was engaging in some sort of hyperbole, and, you know, just... So, I finally told her, if you don't take me to treatment, I'm calling a cab. So, she took me. Okay, this gets better. Okay, so now the head of my department knows. All the students know. Mrs. Roberts knows. So, I got there at like 4 in the morning, so they let me sleep in, and they finally woke me up, and they said, we need you to see the doctor. It gets worse. We need you to see the doctor, and he needs to go home. And I walked in, and there stood Dr. Mahoney, who lived across the street from my parents, whose daughter was my little sister's best friend. Yeah, in a city of, you know, however big Toledo is, you're bound, boom, to run into one or two people, right? So they sent me to this day room, and they gave me this waffle. And I hadn't eaten in 3 days because I decided that alcohol had a lot of calories, so I sort of gave up food. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm trying to eat this waffle. I'm 23 years old. I'm sitting there, I'm trying to eat this waffle, and every time the waffle gets up to my lips, it falls down. And what I really want to do is grab that thing and just chow down on it, right? But no. A woman bustles in, probably about my age now, but I thought of her as an older woman. And she comes in, and she hands me this little card that says, just for today, and with her name and phone number on it. And she says, hi, I was, you know, I'm Shirley. I was just in the nurse's station, and I saw your chart and recognized the name. I went to high school with your dad. So, it gets worse. So I'm sitting there trying to eat this waffle, and she won't leave. She finally leaves, and I picked it up, and I just wolfed it down. excuse me. And sat there looking out the window, and in comes a gaggle of nursing students. Adorable, you know, rosy-cheeked young women. And here I am sitting there with yellow skin, shaking, and my hair, you know, I haven't had a shower in days. And one of them breaks loose from the pack and comes over and says, you don't remember me, do you? Do you remember me? And I'm thinking, oh, God, please don't play this game with me now. You know? And she goes, I'm Robin. I'm Jack's sister. And she starts talking to me about, I'd been in the paper like the month before. She started telling, you know, talking about how they'd seen this article about me and blah, blah, blah. And meanwhile, I'm thinking fraud, fraud, fraud in red over my head. And finally, she goes away. And, you know, I'm all sticky from that syrup and everything, too. It was just a nightmare. And then another girl breaks away, and she comes up, and I knew her right away. Her brother was the president of my high school class, and she hated me in high school, hated me. She came over and talked to me, and she said, well, I'll tell Tom I saw you. Please don't do that. She's like, oh, yeah. So... somebody saved me. They said my counselor needed to see me. And my counselor said I had two choices. I could leave treatment and stay in graduate school, or I could stay there and drop out of graduate school. And I don't know if you know this or not, but for somebody like me, it was really hard to get in. So I said to my counselor, who'd been sober for many, many years, 22 years or something impossible like that, and I said, well, you got sober without going through treatment. Now, I'm not recommending anybody leave treatment, but I said, you got sober without it. Tell me what you did. I'll do that. And if it doesn't work out, I'll come back. And she looked at me for a few minutes, and she said, okay. And so she said, you have to go to an AA meeting. I said, okay. You have to go tonight. Okay. You have to go to a closed meeting. All our closed meetings were discussion meetings. I don't know if it's the same way in Georgia. But she says, and at that meeting, you have to raise your hand, identify yourself as an alcoholic, and ask for help. And so that's what I did. I don't remember anything else about that meeting. I remember one of the girls saying, stay out of wet places. I probably shouldn't even tell you this, but I swear to God, I thought she was talking about sex. It was like a week or two before I figured out what she was talking about. So after a time of going to meetings and so forth, somebody turned to me in a meeting, because they're not as big about crosstalk up there as they are here. And he looked at me and he said, you need a sponsor. Okay. So I called Shirley, you know. She was the only person I knew really well, you know, or well enough. And she was delighted to be my sponsor because we knew some folks in common. And we knew a lot of the same Catholic people and that kind of thing. She wasn't real big on the steps. She sort of rushed me through them, and just kind of like, oh, you don't need to feel bad about that. You know, you're being too hard on yourself. And so I didn't really do a lot of step work with her, but she was all about service work. For example, if I came into this room tonight and all of y'all were sitting here, she would make me go around and shake every person's hand. Every single person in the room would get their handshaken, and I would introduce myself. She had me washing ashtrays back when we smoked in meetings, putting up chairs. And then at 2 years of sobriety, she had me become a general service representative. And she had me speak before 200 people at a general service convention. And I had no idea what I was in for. I was so scared. I was like practically on my knees just begging this guy, tears in my eyes, please don't make me go out there. I'm going to vomit. It's going to be awful. And he looks at me, and he knew I was a counselor by that time, and he goes, hey, Pat, you know how in counseling people talk about things for a really long time, and then they go do them? I was like, yeah. I thought maybe, I convinced him. He said, well, in AA, we do it first, and then we talk about it later. Get out there. So I went out there, and, it was okay. I still hate public speaking. Hate it with a passion. We'll talk about that later, because 33% of the AA membership was women when I came in, and we're way up to, the last census, 34 or 35%. Every woman in this room with over 90 days knows what it's like to walk into a meeting and wonder if you've accidentally walked into a men's meeting. Yeah. So that's why I speak. So after 2 years, I moved down to Florida. I had a sponsor named Dawn. She was all about the steps. She got me working them. I also married somebody in the program. It was not a good marriage. So I thought maybe I better go get a PhD and become a psychologist. So that's what I did. And I dragged him across the country, and then we broke up. It was not a good marriage. I mean, you know, I could have, you know, like opened a phone book and pointed, and you know, we could have both done that and been both of us better off. But, you know, we were sort of like the king and queen of AA. And so we were used to being, you know, big stuff, you know. And we got out to Fresno, California, and nobody cared who we were, you know. And fortunately for me, I met Barb. And Barbara was, she was sort of in the center of the in crowd. I don't know how to put it. So it was fairly easy for me to make the transition, but it really wasn't easy for him. And he was lonely and he was unhappy. And I said, you know, go back to Florida. One of the nice things about Florida was that there were a lot of young women there because there was a halfway house there. And women would come from all over the Southeast. In Toledo, Ohio, those first 2 years, I met maybe two people in their 30s that I hung out with. And everybody else was just, it was me and the little old ladies. There just weren't people in their 20s. There were teenagers who were like 16 and forced in. And then there were people 40 and over. Okay, so moving on. So I dragged him across the country. He went back home. And I met and married someone who was not in the program. And we were married for 20 years. And at that time, my daughters are actually my sixth and seventh pregnancies. And so I spent a lot of time doing bed rest in order to get my daughters and some other things. And ended up with two of the most wonderful people I've ever met. They're the best thing I've ever done. But about that time, and when they were little toddlers, I started doing something I called drifting, because when I was doing bed rest, I got used to doing meetings online and talking to people on the phone. And I thought, well, you know, I have little ones. We didn't believe in babysitters for various reasons. So I really sort of stopped going to real meetings. I did a lot of online stuff and a lot of phoning. And so then I decided to drag him across the United States because I wanted to be near my parents. And at any rate, the marriage was very good until it wasn't. And I left for a very good reason, and I don't share that publicly because other people were involved. But, I, you know, makes me sad that the marriage ended, but I never regret making the decision that I made. So, now, the next time I see one of you guys bird dogging one of my pigeons, I want you to remember this story, okay? I fell head over heels, madly in love with an artist named Caleb. I have Caleb's permission to tell you where his story intersects with mine. He was about 13 years sober. He noticed that I was doing that drifting thing where I'd go to a meeting here, I'd go to a meeting there, but I'd never really let you get to know me. And one night he took me by the hand and he said, "Honey, you need to go to AA." And I said, "What do you mean I need to go to AA? You're the one who doesn't go to meetings." And he didn't. He had stopped going to meetings. So he did what all men of good character do when they see a woman in AA in trouble. And that's, he took me to a group where he knew a group of ladies who had good sobriety. And he took me by the hand and led me over to the sober women. And those women took me in, and they nurtured me, and I started to feel a little less crazy. Everybody told me, you know, you were married for 20 years, you're just now, you know, divorced, this is a rebound. No. Sort of like that first drink, I don't want this to ever stop, I don't ever want to stop feeling this way again. But after being with these women and really sort of getting back on my feet emotionally from the divorce, I realized that it was a rebound. I still talk to him. About a month after I left him, he went back out. And about a month after that, he made two suicide attempts. And he was a very well-known artist in his area. He's now in a nursing home, and he doesn't have the use of his hands. And he uses a wheelchair most of the time. We have a friend who comes by every Thursday night, and if he's up to it, he takes him to the meeting. The last time I talked to him, you know, I think he has some memory issues, because I said, I'm really sorry I didn't bring you that tofu from our favorite Thai restaurant. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, I came to visit you. He didn't even remember it. So this has a point, by the way. This isn't going nowhere. So I have to ask myself, why was he able to help me, but not himself? Why is it for 7 years I got to be the library lady every Tuesday morning at Camp Creek Elementary School? I got to do that. Somebody trusted me to do that. I got to go on Girl Scout trips and help lead my girls. I got to do that. I got to be a present parent. I got to be a psychologist. I got to live the life I decided to live. It hasn't been all smooth sailing after the divorce. Actually it was during the divorce. I was fighting for custody and I lost my home and went bankrupt. So it hasn't all been, you know, smooth sailing, but I've always had this program to fall back on. So my question is, why is it that Caleb could save me, but he couldn't save himself? You remember Sandy, who sat me down at the table? She died in a nursing home of cirrhosis of the liver, leaving three boys. Her husband died in a rehab of a heart attack. She was a teacher. He was a lawyer. I mean, this disease hits everybody. But she was able to save me by being so direct and so forward. My friend Marcia Adagon, I called her brother in Alaska, tracked him down, and I said, Scotty, is it true? And he said, yeah, about 2 weeks ago she called me and she said she wanted to die because she couldn't stop drinking. You remember Jack's sister, Robin? Jack also died from this disease. He killed himself because he lost everything and he couldn't get and stay sober. My friend Sue is dead. My friend Lori is dead. My friend Ann is dead. With the exception of two people, virtually every woman I knew when I was partying is dead now. Most of them by the time we were 50. So why do I get to be here today? Why do I get that seat right there? It has nothing to do with me. Higher power. That's the only conclusion, because I did everything wrong. I didn't do things perfectly in AA. But there were these angels that came along, and I let them help me. Higher power. You know, I have a habit, even in sobriety, of doing what I call walking under pianos. You know, it's like a cartoon that got the piano, and I'm walking around going, oh, everything's fine, you know. Hey, look up. Higher power. So don't drink. Go to meetings. Read the book and pray. Thank you.
they doing without? While others live in high, a big piece of the pie, so many they got it wrong. As for me, when I wanted too much, ain't never enough. Myself, hide it from everyone else, save it for a rainy day. If you wanna have it all the time, gotta give it away. Thought I had me love, kept it on. Time.